Thanks, Katya. Did you get all that? Don't you dare forget it. Katya will come and get you. Right? Okay. So cast your minds back for a moment to last week, to absolute beginners, and I want you to hold that novel in your head as we discuss this. We move on to discussing Williams today. If you think of absolute beginners to start with, some of the key things we discussed there were the relationship between individuals and communities, specific kinds of communities, the relationship between communities and spaces within which the community develops, in that case, London and various parts of London, and the relationship between all those factors and a particular historical moment, expressed in a stylistically adventurous and really invigorating novel. So hold that those key elements in mind as we go on to discuss Williams today, because one of the things that you'll hopefully see for this unit and certainly for the rest of your units as well are lines of continuity between literary and non-literary discussions. So the Williams piece that you hopefully have read in that massive volume that I'm sure all of you have. It's good for biceps as well, by the way. So it's not just a theory textbook. So in that piece, you'll get a gathering of texts that are nominally not literary. They discuss literature, they're critical material. But look out for the common concerns. So the same stuff you read in the literary novels or pieces of fiction that you come across will also be fed through in the theory bit. So what I'm trying to say is don't necessarily think of theory as only a kind of crude key which will help you open the text. Think of Williams and McInnes writing more or less in the same historical moment with the same historical concerns, namely culture, history, community, space. Yes, they write in a different language, but they're meditating on the same topics. And hold that thought in mind as we move through the rest of the unit, because you'll find all our writers doing the same thing. So culture, space, history, I really should have added community there. Those are our topics today. And we'll try and compare Williams' treatment to that of McInnes' from last week. One of the key things, and this is how I want to frame the lecture today, really, one of the key things about Williams are the notions of differentiation and specificity he brings to these ideas of community, history, and culture, as well as space. We'll come to that in a bit. You'll find two movements in Williams. On the one hand, he'll ask you to hold in mind these wide, kind of all-embracing themes. On the other hand, they'll insist that they're not homogeneous identities. They're differentiated. In other words, think of the London of Colin McInnes. You can think of London in terms of urban space, and there are certain things to think of it there. But that urban space is stratified. All of London is not alike. There are certain parts of London that are keyed into a certain register. There are other parts of London that are entirely different. For example, London-Napoli, where our narrator lives, and the London of West End, where he moves around. Now, Williams insists that each space, for example, is differentiated along trajectories and categories. That is to say, whenever we talk of culture, history, space, community, those four key things in Williams' discussion and in McInnes's, of course, those four things we're invited to look at as differentiated categories. There are various subcategories within them, and our task as readers is to decode each of those levels and link them to each other to see whether we can do it, whether it's done differently in literary texts, whether the critical texts approach the issue slightly differently. For example, look at his biographical musings about himself. Suddenly, England wasn't my point of reference. He's talking about growing up. He's coming from Wales. He's come to Cambridge, to university, and he's talking about growing up in England, and he's talking about how an entire vista opened up in front of him when he came to university, pretty much at your age. And he says, England wasn't my point of reference anymore. I was a Welsh European, And both levels felt very different. That's a very typical Williams approach to stuff. He's talking about large categories, Europeanness, English, the idea of England, Welshness, where he comes from, but he's already talking about different levels within it. So for Williams, each category of identity, think of yourselves thinking of yourselves as coming from wherever you come from, England, Wales, outside Europe, inside Europe. We tend to think of these things as natural categories. We tend to think of these things as received ideas. Yes, I'm English, I'm Welsh, I'm Indian, I'm African, I'm West African, and et cetera, et cetera. What Williams is inviting us to do is think of the levels in those ideas. Yes, I'm suddenly, as he says, England wasn't my point of reference. I didn't feel that idea of England could be held as one complete idea. The various levels to it, Welsh, European, and their various levels. So that's a very typical Williams gesture. He's inviting you to think of who you are, where you are located, what kind of culture you come from, what kind of community you're centered within. At the same time, he's asking you to differentiate the types of community and the types of subcultures, subcommunities, subnationalisms, areas, spaces that are built into that space. So whenever you're reading Williams, and whenever you're thinking of, let us say, McInnes in this context, think of how each of those categories of space, history, culture, and community are at the same time large, useful, hold-all categories, but they're finely differentiated. In the case of Williams, he feels simultaneously English, Welsh, European, and they all operate at different levels. So the first thing to keep in mind in terms of how we read Williams is the idea of historically specific but historically differentiated cultures, spaces, and communities. Now, those of you are familiar with or have managed to read the Williams piece, I want to start with that first quote on your handout, which brings us to the second key point in Williams's thinking. So the first key point is the idea of differentiated and specific categories of identity, whoever we think we are that, but we are also more than that. There are various levels to our sense of belonging. The second category is this. This is your first quote. In the long history of human settlements, remember in the piece, Williams starts by talking about two different, apparently very different, spaces. Rural spaces and urban spaces. The country and the city is what he starts talking of. And this is what he says. In the long history of human settlements, this connection between this land from which directly and indirectly we all get our living and the achievements of the human society has been very deeply known. This quote, I suggest, brings us to the second idea, key idea in Williams's thinking, the idea of deep history, deep ideas, and deep belonging. Now, again, cast your mind very quickly back to last week when we were talking about McInnes and Absolute Beginners. One of the things that the narrator achieves towards the end is this idea of a depth of belonging. Remember, he starts the novel by saying, you know, London is my playground, I can go here, I can go there, I do all these exciting things, but there's a germ of discomfort that throws him from time to time. Who am I? What is my relationship with my friends? Which community do I actually belong to? Or who are really my friends when it comes to it? What is Englishness? Am I English? Well, what does that mean in a historical moment when the notion of who English people are changing? That's the kind of journey he takes. And towards the end, he arrives, after a lot of struggle, to some notions of belonging, however contested and problematic that is. Remember, he says, welcome to England, meet your first teenager. So those are settled ideas that he's arrived at. He's arrived at a notion of Englishness that has expanded. He's arrived at a notion of teenager, i.e. himself, that is also a result of all the combinations and permutations of relationships he's been through. Now, for Williams, that the second key idea that arrives at with any culture at a given point is this idea of deep belonging and deep ideas. In other words, at any given historical moment, you might feel yourself to be X at a particular city, at a particular time. What Williams is asking us to be attentive to is a very, very long tradition by which that idea of X, whatever it is produced, right? It is not a natural given. You're not born with it. It's a question of a long tradition of thoughts, of struggles, of actions that have produced this idea that you inherit of who you are. So every community, Williams suggests, has this idea of deep history behind it. Whatever community you come from, you typically think of yourself of having been born naturally within it. That idea of beginning we were talking about last week, absolute beginning, we start afresh every time we are born, etc. Williams is suggesting that is at best partially true. What you have to keep in mind is that deep tradition that, for example, a Welsh mining community that he was born into that feeds your idea of who you are. So the notion of beginnings and fresh starts are very important to us, to individuals, as individuals. We are born at a certain time. We move through history at a certain pace. The second key theme in Williams, after what we've just talked about, is the idea of the existence of a very deep historical attachment to the idea of who you are. In other words, our identities. Of course, and this is this. Those of you who know Williams' fiction will realize his Welsh identity of the mining countryside, etc., comes back to haunt his work in very interesting ways, his critical work in very interesting ways. The third key point about Williams' thinking, we have already hinted at this, is, okay, we have these deep ideas about historical belonging, deep ideas of historical moments about who we are. We think that they're natural. Actually, they're historically produced. But they're not merely historically produced, they're also immensely contested ideas, right? They're varied and contested ideas. In other words, our identity, whoever we think we are is not homogeneous, it's stratified, and it's a product of historical contest. And for the rest of the lecture, we'll move through with this idea of contested ideas about who we are, about identities. For example, he takes the he focuses on countryside here, and that is a fairly recognizable view of the countryside, isn't it? When you see that picture, Williams says attitudes to the country persisted with extraordinary power. What is that? First of all, does that seem recognizable to you, or does that seem, you know, slightly weird? What do you think of that painting? Is that something that you automatically click when you think of countryside? Yeah? Not only countryside, British countryside. Okay, may I ask why? What are the features of that painting that says, it could be from anywhere in this world, obviously, that says countryside and British countryside? Any feature that leaps out? Yep. So rolling hills in the background?
No, I mean, I think the hills are more in the foreground. I mean, Europe tends to be a bit more flat.
Okay, yep. And that suggests, why does this suggest Britishness? Does it suggest Britishness to you?
Yeah, a little bit more than a flat landscape,
yeah. Okay, a little varied, probably quite gentle slopes, not craggy like Mont Blanc, for example, not the Alps. There's a suggestion of variation, but gentle variation, for example, right? What about the human figures on the foreground? Tame. Does it appear tame to you? Likeable? Will you feel, you know, for example, when you're walking back from the lecture at night, would you feel threatened if you cross that field? Particularly? You might, of course. You know, but if it was at night, would you cross that field? You would be scared. You're not a good English person. No English person would be scared of crossing that field. In other words, what you're getting is an association of idea that appears to arrive at us fully formed. You have the gentle rolling hills, you have the productive countryside, you have the laborers in front of you, you have the trees on the margins. This appears to be typical to us for specific reasons. What Williams is suggesting is just like the ideas of who we are, the fact that we immediately recognize that as a British countryside, and in particular as a pleasant and non-threatening British countryside, although that idea appears to be quite natural for us, of course this is, you know, completely unthreatening. Of course, those two men working there, I think both of them are men, the resolution isn't very good, are perfectly jolly laborers who will stand us pints of cider at the end of the work, etc., etc. The fact that we don't immediately clock them as kind of completely psychotic mass murderers, for example, that fact has arrived at us through a particular conjunction of historical events. Okay? So that idea of attitudes of country persisting with extraordinary power, think of how we received the city and the country in McInnes's novel, for example. Remember that little quite strange episode when the narrator goes out with his father to the countryside on a boat. So we have all these jagged, edgy, cool, slightly dangerous descriptions of the city, and the narrator is thrown by the fact that the countryside appears to be, as he says, like, it's like a painting on a box of chocolates. Right? It has a completely different connotation, and he's slightly unsettled by that. He's going with his father, which at best of times, as you know, those of you been on trips with your parents, can be slightly unsettling. But in addition to that, the space that he finds around, that he finds himself in, also throws him. This is slightly different from the city that he's used to. In other words, he's automatically programmed to take the country, in a particular way. Right? Look at your quote here, though. So hold on to that idea of received and very powerful ideas of what spaces are, whatever spaces they are. We're just using the country, the rural space, as an example here. And William suggests that they have extraordinary power. We automatically take these things as given. That, of course, the countryside is like that. Or, of course, the city is like that. Of course, our neighborhood in a particular city is like this. It ought, and this is your third quote in your handout, it ought in any case to be clear that the English experience is especially significant, he says, in that one of the decisive transformations, and this is your third key element in Williams's thought, the idea of transformation. So apparently this countryside is unchanging, right? You can say this is an English rural scene from, I don't know, the 13th century onwards, right, down to today. There's an unbroken appearance of countryside that we can grasp at even if we just step out of the city, right? But note what William says here, and note that accent on transformation, occurred there very early, in and through these differences all the same, certain images and associations persist. And the following quote, in and through these transforming experiences, English attitudes to the country and to the idea of rural life, and that's the end of your quote on top, persisted with extraordinary power. So this country life had its meanings, but these changed in themselves and changed in relation to others. Now, there you've arrived at points 3 and points 4 in Williams's thinking. The simultaneous idea of transformation and persistence. Think of what he says about the countryside. So this picture appears to us as being timeless. That is how we normally take this particular picture. What Williams is asking us to be attentive to is that the countryside, the historical countryside that this picture represents, has experienced very early on in history and has continued to do so a series of really cataclysmic transformations, right? The countryside has historically changed and continues to change in a dynamic, traumatic, and really decisive fashion. The same goes for the city, obviously. If you look at this idea of the city, that gives you a sense of stereotypical, in some senses, the idea of what a city is. As the Williamsian quote on top will tell you, the idea of possibility of meeting movement. The sense of the cities there. You see that kind of idealistic white building rising at behind, bathed in shining light, and the kind of slightly dark, smoggy tenements in the front, suggesting both sides of city life. The idea of possibilities, of meeting, of civilization, of culture, of architectural splendor and all kinds of other kinds of splendor. At the same time, the dark, edgy side of the city, the bathed or concealed in the darkness in the foreground. Again, those are very settled and powerful idea of what spaces are. Now, what Williams is asking us to think of are two related ideas. One, both this space and the country space, just to take two examples, arrive at us with an aura of timelessness. We always think, okay, whatever the cities are, from Rome down to London, they are this captures two sides of what a city is meant to be. The flip side, the countryside, that painting you just saw, they suggest the elemental timeless qualities of the countryside. Now, Williams is asking us, and remember, these are representations of city spaces and country spaces. What he's asking us to think about is this. Historically, both the city space and the country space have experienced and continue to experience decisive transformations. This will be a key element in your understanding of Williams, the idea of transformations. At the same time, the idea of persistence of ideas. So why do we think of the countryside as that and the city as this, despite all the varied and continuing transformations that are actually happening today and have always happened? So there are two things happening. One, the decisive alterations of these spaces. Two, the continuity of certain ideas. In other words, there seem to be a lack or a lag between what happens historically and what happens culturally, right? The cultural representations, paintings, books, music, and so on, tend to give us a picture, or there's a possibility that they represent certain ideas at the very moment the historical basis of those ideas have changed, right? The countryside is clearly, how many of you are experienced, for example, of working, living, or growing up in countryside? Okay, that's an excellent number. Can you tell me a couple of things that don't fit into that picture? From your lived experience? Sorry? People don't. So the idea of labor has changed. How are fields work now?
Illegal immigrants.
Okay, illegal immigrants is one possibility. And large machinery. So for those of you who work and live in the countryside, immediately one of the false historical notes that will be struck by this picture are who are working there. Yeah? Anything else about lived experience? Yes?
It's not,
excellent point. It's normally nowhere near this beautiful. Okay? You've forgot that has forgotten to include rain, muck, midges, whatever you want to call it, right? So in other words, historically, the idea of countryside goes through a certain series of changes and have historical specificities. The cultural representation of it might tend to give you an idea about it rather than what is actually going on, rather than the rain and the muck and so on. Now, that leads us to a kind of interesting tension in Williams's thinking. And this is something that you have to assess. Remember, all the theory that you're reading, I would implore you not to take them as the kind of biblical word on the end of everything, right? The theory that you're reading is meant to be tested against your experiences and your analysis of it, okay? So whenever you're reading Williams, for example, or you read Jameson next week, don't take their word as the last word on spaces or cultural community, whatever it is. Test it out, analyze it, and look out for internal tensions and contradictions, okay? This gives this particular idea of the lag, cultural lag, between what actually historically happens brings us to one of the first points of tension in Williams' thinking. So how are we going to take culture then? Is culture something that always gives us a false impression or slightly outdated impression or slightly manufactured impression of what actually happens in history? How are we to take this lag between historical reality and cultural reality? And that is a tension that is both productive in Williams's thinking, but also potentially destabilizing. Because as cultural readers, what are we doing then? Are we always looking for hints for a false consciousness, as it were, in the writing? That is to say, whenever we read about a novel about the countryside, or look at a painting, or look at a cinema, or listen to a piece of music, are we always impelled to treat it with slight suspicion? That is to say, it is giving us a slightly packaged idea of what really goes on. Or is there a relationship, a more positive relationship, between what goes on in paintings, in books, in pictures, etc., and the historical reality outside the text? In other words, what we have arrived at as one of the key junctions of tension in critical theory, that is to say, the relationship between what goes inside the text and what goes outside the text, and how are we to test that relationship. Okay, I'm leaving this as an open question now. Again, think of McInnes's novel. How are we to take that? Do we read that as a social document of what actually happened, how London changed, for example, at a particular point in late 50s? Or do we take it as a representation that gives us that, but also gives us something else? If so, what is that something else? Is it that space where we put and code what we call the literary? Otherwise, in other words, what are the differences between kinds of cultural utterance about reality? If all of you are asked to write, let us say, a short story about your experiences between 10 and 11 in this room, okay, how would we read that? Would we take that as a fictional document about what this particular grim reality you find yourselves in? Or would you take that as a, blow by blow, completely straight on? Expression of what actually happened. So note this tension between cultural texts and historical reality that will feed through in most of the critics, certainly you read in this particular unit. How are we to assess it? What are our grounds of assessment of that picture and rural reality? So two things we have to do simultaneously. Be aware of the historical transformations. At the same time, be aware that certain ideas, if you like, they persist. They act as residues in our imagination, right? We think of that particular image of countryside because it's kind of filtered into our head and sedimented and settled down. So despite the fact that a lot of us have lived in the country and have mucked through the mud and the rain, when you see this picture, the first hit you see is, oh, okay, this is a lovely painting of the countryside. And then you might, the critical faculty might hit in. So what is that tension between our consciousness of reality and a cultural consciousness? That's the first tension between transformation and persistence that rises in Williams's thinking. With that, we've come to our final two themes. Sorry, I'm going the wrong way. In Williams. One is the stuff that I've just mentioned. How are we to take culture? Here's another example of a persistent idea of the countryside. You see the Austinian countryside, we might call it. Again, you have ordered gardens, you have the ordered mansion rising from the gardens, etc. Immediately, whenever we look at it, fed by annual diets of BBC revivals of Austin, we think of that immediately as Austinian. But remember, the historical idea of what Austin is writing about is changing, but we still go with a persistent idea of what the Austinian landscape is. Our question here is why we do so. In other words, how do we read culture? Now, one of the ways of reading culture, this is your fourth key idea in Williams's thinking, this is on your handout. Since the relationship between country and the city is not only an objective problem and history, but has been and still is for many millions of people, a direct and intense, much like a lot of you who raised your hands about living in the countryside, direct and intense preoccupation and experience. In other words, the relations are not only of ideas and experience, but of rent and interest, of situation and power. And here's a key theme in the Williamsian idea of what a culture is, a wider system. Okay, so with culture, with the Williamsian idea of culture, we have arrived at the idea of a material culture, a wider system. When you look at that particular expression of the Austinian landscape, what Williams wants us to be attentive to is not only the idea of transformation and persistence of particular kinds of ideas about spaces, but about what culture really is. In other words, we picked up that book, we've read Austin, we've seen the films, but that doesn't limit the parameters of what culture is. As he says, there's rent, there's power relations, there's a system. In other words, one of the things we do as cultural readers is contextualize what we are reading, and this seems to be a very basic point to you at the moment, but I'll expand on it at the moment in a bit. What we are reading, what we are seeing, what we are consuming, what we are listening to, within an ecology that is more than just textual, okay? So it's more than music, it's more than literature, it's more than painting, it's more than architecture, art, whatever it is. It's a relationship. Imagine a field, and it's a relationship between each component of that field. That is what culture is for Williams. Imagine a big field called culture. In between, you have what we take very regularly as cultural elements, everything that I've just mentioned. But there are also other things going on there. When you look at that house, what Williams is inviting us to think of when we're reading Austin, for example, who owns that house historically? What is the rent of that house? What kind of people can live in that house? What is their relationship to people who don't live in that house? And I've been and dot the kind of perimeters of that huge, very rambling, very beautiful estate. Historically, what has happened to them? Why has the artist, in this case Jane Austen, made a certain amount of choices, a certain number of choices about writing about that and not about the other things? How do we read the things that are absent from the picture? Okay, so one of the things that the Williamsian idea of culture invites us to do is to compare not just text with text, which we regularly do, obviously, and by text, I don't just mean readable text, as in with words in it, but any kind of text, musical, filmic, and otherwise. We regularly compare the two and come up with comparisons, but also, and come up with conclusions, but also what do those texts not speak about that are actually a part of a much wider cultural system? So when we think of culture in Williams, we're thinking of, and this is a key term, material culture. How do we read words in books against something that seems so alien to words? Something like the practice of renting a house or letting out a house. If you're thinking of London and Napoli again from last year's novel, and there's that passage about renting and who can afford to live there. Remember, the narrator can only afford to live there because he's got a very quirky landlord who occasionally comes to collect the rent and not do anything about the house at all. It's basically falling down, etc. How does that compare when we're doing a cultural reading of that particular part of the novel? How do we compare that description to what is happening outside the novel? So, and in fact, outside what we nominally take to be culture. In other words, in the realm of the housing market of London in the 50s. So when we're doing a cultural investigation for Williams, we're invited to look in at every aspect of a material culture. Not just literary, of course you can do that and you have to do that. Not just close reading, which you must do, which lies at the heart of your analysis. But how do you conjunct that close reading with your wider sense of how a society operates? So one of the things you think of in Williams's writing, and in fact in McInnes's writing as well in the novel, is this invitation to think of all culture as material culture. Okay? And again, think of the tensions that might arise from that particular move. I'll end with two examples of various kinds of cultural utterance and the basis of comparison, because that brings me to my final point about Williams, the importance of comparing texts and the basis for that comparison. Here, Williams, on the one hand, has spoken of a wider cultural realm, but in conclusion, he brings us to the importance of literary investigation, of close, in fact, nearly microscopic attention on what texts do. Think of yourselves, if you can, as really white-coated laboratory assistants in this big system called culture, right? Although I realize that might be quite a geeky image. Don't worry about that. That's precisely what you're doing, okay? For example, look at these two utterances about the same area of England, written mostly around the same time. The first by William Cobbett, very different book to Jane Austen's Emma, of course. How many of you have read Emma, by the way, or seen Emma? So this is a recognizable passage from you. For example, Emma is describing a particular estate, its ample garden stretching down to meadows, washed by a stream, its abundance of timber in rows and avenues, neither fashion nor extravagance has rooted up. The house was larger than Hartfield, which is Emma's house, covering a good deal of ground, rambling and irregular, with many comfortable one or two handsome rooms. Look at the key terms there. Comfortable, handsome, rambling, extravagance, meadows, washed by a stream. You have this idea of a large, comfortable, comforting presence of a particular kind of space. Look at Cobbett. He's looking at the same area of England, a few years give and take, and that's what he says. He's looking, so imagine Cobbett, in a kind of time traveler's wife experiment. Think of Austen and Cobbett standing side by side. They're looking at the same perspective. This is what Austen chooses to write about. That's what Cobbett chooses to write about. The land just about here does seem to be really bad. The face of the country is naked. Contrast that with what Austen is writing. The few scrub trees that now and then meets the eye, and even the quicksets, are covered with a yellow moss. All is bleak and comfortless. Cobbett has completely cut out that vision of the country house, the rambling comfort, the grounds, the ample gardens, the stream, etc., from his vision. Yes? He's given us the same picture of the countryside from a completely different perspective that captures one particular aspect of, and one important aspect of, how the country appears to him. Austen chooses to do something completely different. She gives us a very different idea of what a countryside is. Now, as literary and cultural critics, what Williams is asking us to do, okay, usually Austen arrives at us first in the form of prescribed texts, in the form of, as I said, BBC revivals, in the form of a plethora of critical writing about Jane Austen. She's someone much more familiar to us. It's easier for us to visualize that particular idea of a countryside. What Williams is saying, you're obliged to do that and analyze those particular kind of positionings in Austen, that picture of comfort, not opulence, comfort, that picture of familiarity, that picture of abundance. We are obliged to analyze that, but as cultural critics, we are also obliged to go outside to a text that is completely different, that register is completely different, and then investigate the result. Why are certain authors making a certain kind of choice about perspectives? What are the different perspectives available to us? How do we piece together all these perspectives about a certain era, let us call it 1818 to 1820 England, or mid-1820s England? How do we piece together all these perspectives and then arrive at a more complete picture of the entire cultural and material system of what England is at that time? How do we achieve that? It appears to us as a daunting task. Obviously, you can collate any different number of texts, paintings, pictures, etc., which will give you a variety of perspectives. Daunting as it may be, Williams suggests that is what we are obliged to do as literary critics. First step, close attention to the texture of the literature. So all those terms, what kind of picture they conjure up, and then a kind of contrasting them or bringing them next to a wide variety of texts and testimonies of the historical material system of a particular period. I've given you one example. You can come up with many, many more. Again, be attentive to how Cobbett chooses to position the countryside, that accent on bleakness, comfortlessness, etc., etc. The country here does seem to be really bad, etc. How do we read that? What is the tonal register of that? In other words, we become not just critics, but literary forensic experts. That is what Williams's method drives us towards being. Our final example, now looking at an urban space here, London. The mode at which this particular kind of writing arrives. Again, you'll see McInnes and James Hannay. They're separated by a century here. McInnes gives that particular description where he lives in, or where his narrator lives in London. No, give me our London Napoli I've been describing. Broken milk bottles everywhere, scattering the asphalt roads like snow, and cars parked in streets looking as if they're stolen or abandoned, and a strange number of male urinals. Yeah? So immediately you get, it starts with this invitation of, give me our London Napoli. I love this derelict, cool, rundown area with hints of strange sexual shenanigans going on there. This is great, he says. And look at the description of what is evidently quite a rundown area, broken milk bottles, etc., now given a positive twist. Same area of London, 100 years ago, pretty much describing the same scenario, James Hannay. In the very heart of London, in its densest and closest parts, in the long, narrow lanes, in vile, dark cellars dwell in huddled thousands the children of the poor. Hannay is also, by the way, interested in the state, moral state of teenagers growing up in that particular environment. Fresh air, pure water, wholesome food come never to their dwellings. The very light of heaven struggles to the filthy panes of the coarse glass to reach them. The air is heavy with tainted matter. And he goes on to show how that particular space and environment taints the morality and the growth of the children of that area. Same part of London, pretty much the same narrative figures. Here, the teenager, the child, is exulting in this kind of dilapidated ruin of the city. The second one strikes a much more darker tone. As cultural forensic lab workers, what we are doing is comparing two disparate texts. We are noting that helps us to give us a more rounded picture of what London or particular kind of particular space in London is, the historical span, the tonal register, the images, and the difference in narrative positions. What do we get from there? What does this particular comparison give us? An idea about a community, a historical moment, the idea of transformations, etc., that we've talked about. So that is really what Williams wants us to do. In other words, be attentive to the style, the mode of reading, I had said early on there, mode of reading, the particular style of a cultural product that's keyed in to both its immediate lived material space and its historical moment. Why does Hannay write like that? How can McInnes write like that? Partly because of the difference in the era, partly because of the difference or the developments and the changes and transformations in that particular space, partly because both of them are working with the same literary trope about the city, about the dangerous city. So as critics, as readers, we are factoring in all those things in our reading as we read. The final point I want you to take away today is this: the idea of each cultural or literary text that you read are keyed in to a particular kind of historical space and community. Our task is to determine what that relationship is, and that task won't be complete if we just confine ourselves to comparing nominally literary texts to each other, but we should expand. We're compelled to expand our horizon into taking in various kinds of texts, literary and non-literary, and run them against each other. What we arrive at is an idea of material culture. Yeah? That's what Williams wants you to think. Next week, we hold on to that idea of styles, literary styles. In other words, everything that you read or see or listen to, and the correspondence between that and a historical moment, because that is what Jameson is talking about. The idea of culture as a as a particular style and the relationship between that style and a particular kind of space and historical moment. That we'll discuss in Jameson, in the Jameson piece next week.